What's up, y'all? Today we dive in with the amazing Kat Harris to talk about her and her new book, Sexless in the City. We've had a conversation like this before about whether or not you would have sex pre-marriage. I know I just ruffled a whole bunch of feathers, but it's such an interesting conversation to figure out how many of us being married would do it all differently if we had the chance to do it again. So we dive in to figure out, where does your morality stand? Where do your convictions lie? What's right? What's wrong? To you, not to everybody else. It's going to be an amazing conversation. Can't wait. Here is Knights at the Round Table. And welcome to another episode of Knights at the Round Table. Tis your boy, Man Weezy, and my queen to the right of me now.
Hello.
Angela Johnson.
Yes.
B is away training right now, but we had the privilege of getting this beautiful guest on our podcast, and this was the time that she was available. So... yeah, so we're making it happen. What's up, Kat?
What's up? How are you guys doing?
Chilling, or as I see her on Instagram as the refined woman. That's such a
so regal.
It's very like
so regal and church conference-y of you.
Where'd you get that title?
Oh my gosh, dress for the job that you want, not the job you have, guys.
Yes.
I also wear maternity pants sometimes.
Yeah. Wait, quick. Tell me where that title's from. Where do you get that from?
Oh, where the refined woman is from?
Yeah.
Okay. So the refined woman has been running for about 9 years. And so at the beginning, it used to be a style blog. And I actually hate sharing that now because it is so bad. Like
if we scroll back to the archives, we're going to be style question mark?
Gray shorts with gray tights with a gray sweater. Like, what was I trying to? Here's the deal is I loved Gossip Girl and I loved Blair Waldorf from Gossip Girl.
Sure.
But I was like broke ass and making like $10 a day at my photography job. And so, yeah. So refined was more like this, like, refined taste and style.
So like you've done the work to refine your style.
Be refined.
I'm with it.
And now, like about 9 years later, I mean the brand and what I do is so different now.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's more like what happens when we kind of lose that mask of perfection or that Superman cape and we are thrown into the fire of life and we get refined by that. Like,
ooh.
Who are we when we're in the refining?
Yeah. I see what you did there.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, well, I got to keep the name, but we got to change the name. We got to change the meaning.
The meaning, the pitch. Well, I love it because I was looking at, before obviously we had you on, I was looking up all the content, everything that you post on there. And I'm like, man, I feel like she's like-minded. And I mentioned an ARC podcast, P.S. Everybody who's listening, go listen to part one of this podcast, which is on her page. And we'll put it in the description.
And what's the name of your podcast? Tell everyone.
It's The Refined Collective.
The Refined Collective. So we will definitely put the link in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed, I told her, I was like, you got a little bit of us in you. There's a little bit of flavor and a little bit of funk. Like, she ain't all Caucasian.
She used and seasonings.
I'm not. I love Caucasians. All of our Caucasian listeners, we love you so much. But you know what I mean. When you got one of yours that is more like one of ours and... And we can accept
that.
We can all accept that, you know? It's one of ours. Man, so what started you on this journey, like, of refining?
Yeah, so I think, for me, nothing about my life has been linear.
Sure.
I mean, I grew up in a very dysfunctional home. There was, you know, divorces, affairs, and drug addictions, and poverty, and I'm one of six kids, so, you know, that is a whole other, you know, added element to being in a big family with a lot of pain and heartache going on.
Where do you fall in that lineup? And
I am second oldest.
Okay.
So my brother is the oldest, and then there's five girls.
Oh, wow. So you're the oldest girl. So you still had to take care of everybody.
Girl. Yeah. So we range from 37 to 18.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So my youngest sister is 18, and I like to joke that she's my mentor. She's like, how's your heart? And I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm not doing well today. Help me. So I feel like I've always been that person that I can't hide the heart on my sleeve. I can't pretend there's not an elephant in the room. I kind of came out of the womb ruffling feathers. And in that, you know, I became a person of faith. I became a Christian in high school, and that looked one way for a really long time. And then doubt and life kicking me in the teeth a few times just sort of shifted that a little bit. And so I feel like so much of my life and my journey, even nothing about my career trajectory, has been linear. It's been a lot of refining. I was a full ride athlete in college. I played tennis, and then I transitioned to being a Bible major. And then I left college to be in the nonprofit world. And then I went into the fashion editorial world about 10 years ago. And now I'm writing I just wrote a book about sex and God. Yeah. So yeah, I feel like refining is just like, man, life is, nothing's linear about it. And the more we can kind of twist and turn and be fluid with it and allow ourselves to be refined as opposed to resisting it.
When you became Christian, did your whole family become Christian as well, or was it just you?
So, good question. I was one of the only ones in my family that was Christian when I became a Christian.
Okay.
And you shared on our last conversation, Angela, that you became a Christian at a church camp.
Mm-hmm.
Same.
Me too.
I got invited by all of my friends that I would party with to the church camp. And I was like, are all the hot guys going?
Mm-hmm.
I'll go.
That's why I went.
I don't know if all the hot guys are going.
That's how they sold me on it. They were like, hot girls are going to be there. I'm like, I'm in.
Yeah. Joke was on me. By the end of the week, I'm baptized. I'm crying.
Yeah.
I go back home and I'm like, you guys, Jesus loves you and we got to read our Bibles and I'm changing things up around here. And my family was like, what the hell? Where did you go? Mm-hmm. Why are you so annoying?
Yeah, I
think they probably still think that about me.
So when
you're so loud,
you quit tennis to do Bible major instead. Was your family like pissed? Like, what are you doing?
Yes, my family, I feel like I kind of walked out of their blessing on my life when I went, well, first when I got my belly button pierced in college and I got a tattoo, my mom was like, no, evil, Satan. So that was the first thing. And then honestly, for my family, walking away from tennis was less about a spiritual thing and more like, you've worked your whole freaking life for this. And the only way that I ever knew I was going to be able to go to college is if I got a full ride scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it felt very weird to them that I left that to go to study the Bible.
Yeah.
So the Bible.
So how are you going to make money though?
Yeah. So for you in your life, the Bible was like the bad boy boyfriend that you started dating, that your family was like, no, what are you doing? You've worked so hard and you're giving it all up for this guy.
That's funny because my parents were the same way. Like, I went to Bible college.
Really?
I had full rides to all the state schools because of my grades. And I decided to go to Bible college and they were like, what are you doing? You have to pay. Like, they're a private college, so they don't accept a lot of state funding. So I got some scholarships, but I still had to pay to go there, and they couldn't, you know, connect the two of why I wanted to go. And I was just like, Mom, I want to learn more about Jesus. I got to go where they're teaching Jesus.
I got to go.
And it wasn't even that I was planning on using
it.
I'm super glad. I mean, I was never planning to use school. I only went because it was like, all right, Lord, you haven't gotten me signed yet, so I guess I need to go do something while I'm waiting for to get signed. And so I was like, well, I love learning about you. Let me just go to Bible college and we'll just learn some more about you.
Aw, you're cute.
Yeah, it's literally where I went. The whole time when I walked in the first day and I went to talk to my the guy that's helping you sign up for school and decide your major. I was like, can you just give me a major where I'm not going to fall asleep? I just need whatever one that is the least likely for me to fall asleep in class. And they're like, are you not interested in anything? I was like, I'm going to be a musician. So this is just in between. So just give me something. Yeah. And they're like, you like TV? And I was like, I love TV. So like, communications. I was like, cool. I don't know what that is, but you can sign me up for all the communication classes And that's what I did. But my parents didn't understand until I got out of college and I put out some CDs, and then they fell in line, and my mom now is my biggest fan.
Look,
but that's,
that.
You know,
that full circle.
I wanted to ask you something though, because I know you said that there was some, was there a specific catalyst? Because here, you know, at Night's Table, we're like hella, we like being hella raw and as real as you can, but there is no such thing as too real. So was there like an actual catalyst that took you from two things, from finding God, you know, and then second, from being so bold to write a book called Sexless in the City, you know, like, because those are just two very, you know, ain't Christians, if you're talking about sex, you're talking about it in the most safest way that you can talk about it, because you don't want to not get in life way.
Missionary position, right, with the lights on.
Right. Yeah. And don't even call it sex. Call it the hanky panky or something.
Yeah. Call it the Lord's will.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, I want to know, because those are two, you know, very big steps in your life / career. So was there a catalyst for either or just one of them? Or?
Man, I feel like there's definitely more. It feels like there was more of a catalyst of when I decided to write the book, because it was, that was me completely changing the trajectory of my career. And I feel like becoming a Christian was, there was, I mean, it was like, I can look back and say, you know, God was working, but there was not this, I was this crazy teen. I followed the rules and I was a quote unquote good kid because I wanted to get a full ride scholarship to a D1 school.
Right.
So that wasn't necessarily a huge like catalyst, like coming to faith. I mean, I felt radically changed when I did, but more so I think as far as stuff with the book goes, I have been in the fashion industry for 12 years. I've been a full-time photographer. It's still my main squeeze. It still brings in about 70% of my income. I'm super grateful for it.
Nice.
And then I started this Refined Woman thing where it was a style blog, like I said. And then how it made me money was I would do brand consulting and social media strategy for different fashion houses and brands. And I was not even public about my faith. It wasn't even a part of the conversation until about 3 years ago. And I was going through my own personal journey of moving to New York and dating up a storm and figuring out, what do I believe about God and sex outside of this shame-filled purity culture narrative that I had been given my whole life that I never questioned until I started dating someone and was like, take my panties off. I want to have sex right now. So I was like, oh, it's like so easy to kind of preach this message of not having sex. And then I found when I was actually put in the position,
given the opportunity,
it was much harder.
Yeah.
Given the opportunity, it was much harder to not have sex. And so I never talked about that publicly. It was just kind of more of a personal journey of, what do I believe about God and sex? And then a couple years ago, I was on a podcast and she was like, oh, like, what's dating like in New York? And I told her, well, here's what's been going on in my life. I'm a virgin and I'm 30 and I don't really know what I believe about God and sex anymore. And I'm still choosing to abstain, but it's for completely different reasons now. Some have to do with my faith, but some have to do with science and neuroplasticity and deciding what I want in a relationship. And that podcast ended up kind of going viral. And then I started getting book offers and I was like,
wow,
I don't want to write a book about this. Like, I do brand strategy. I do social media marketing. I don't talk out loud to people about my faith and sex. Mm. And I don't want people knowing about the most intimate details of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I turned it down for about 6 months.
Wow.
Because I was like, I do not want to be the poster child in Christian culture. Like, we saw Josh Harris all those years ago.
Yeah.
I was dating goodbye and look how that worked out for him. Like, I don't want to step into that.
Right.
So it definitely felt like a huge pivot to embrace that publicly. And then writing the book is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
So, when you said, did you say neuroplasticity?
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because that is a word I haven't heard yet, nor have we described sex in that way. So I'm very curious. What is that?
Yeah, so, well, neuroplasticity talks about, is kind of the science behind our brains. And essentially, our brains are so smart. I feel like God designed this, like, amazing machine. And our brain is always looking for patterns and short circuits. Like, oh, this is what happens. So, for example, I struggle with anxiety. Oh, I have a panic attack at church. And then my brain is like, oh, so that's what we do, right? We have panic attacks at church. So mm-hmm. a neural pathway is created. It's like a bicycle pathway in your brain so that your brain doesn't have to think about, here's what we do in this situation. This is just what we do. And so then every time you go to church, I'm having a panic attack. And the cool thing about what neuroplasticity teaches, which I wonder if in scripture this is what it means to take your thoughts captive, but neuroplasticity basically says you can teach an old dog new tricks. Mm. Just because you have patterns in your brains, beliefs, narratives, just because you've always struggled with being broke doesn't mean that's how it has to be. So it's really saying you literally can change the science and makeup of your brain by changing the narratives in your mind. So it's that, like, learning about that was super fascinating. And then when I talk about that in regards to sex, something that was super interesting to me when I was researching, because I was researching, what do I believe about sex? And I was reading books by Jewish feminists and New York Times authors who aren't Christians, and also reading Christian stuff too. But it was the quote unquote secular, or whatever you want to call it. It was the scientific research that I learned about sex that felt so compelling to me. One of them being, there's a woman out there, Helen Fisher. And then there's also a therapist, Esther Perel. Mm-hmm. And Helen really talks about how there's no such thing as casual sex, because the makeup of our brains and the hormones released and the neurotransmitters released, like dopamine, oxytocin, like oxytocin is that bonding agent that's released when you hold hands with someone, and when a mother's breastfeeding her baby and they're looking at each other in the eyes. And then dopamine is that reward center, like, oh, you're in kindergarten, you raise your hand, you get a gold star when you're called on. And so then pretty soon you don't even know that you need the gold. You don't need the gold star to know. You only talk when you raise your hand. And so the idea is that because of the bonding agents from dopamine and oxytocin, it really makes it pretty hard, some would say impossible, to experience more casual sex, because the hormones in our body don't really allow for it.
Wow.
And I have more that I could say about it, but I can sit there. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that.
Man, well, I think when you talk about the neuroplasticity, that reminds me, what came up to me was when I was a kid, I remembered my first ever stomach ache happened in my downstairs bathroom. And so that was in Kansas. And so for the rest of the time, which was 3 years that I lived in that house, I would not use the bathroom downstairs. Because in my mind, I thought, if I use the bathroom down there, I'm going to get a stomach ache. So I can't tell you how many fights I had of, like, get out of the bathroom, I have to go. And people were like, just use the downstairs bathroom. And I'm like, I can't. I'm going to get a stomach ache. And it was, like, so real for me that I didn't use the bathroom. But that's interesting.
And now
that,
look at you. That's what still it's having stomach issues connected to your brain.
Well, mainly because
and
I've
like, and now we don't have two-story houses ever because we don't go to the bathroom.
No, I have trauma with bathrooms. Now it makes me feel better when they're available. But this
gives hope that there could be some neural pathways changed with your bathroom issues.
I have rearranged my life. I've done way better.
You have done way better. Yeah, you still got a ways to go, but you have done way better.
Oh, stop. But I think that's beautiful to learn, especially in when it comes to sex. I think the more, and it's probably something that we should talk about more, but I know that the church as a whole, I don't want to blanket it, most of the church as a whole, when it comes to the Western church, view science as almost like the enemy of us.
Yeah.
Because science has tried so hard to disprove our religion, that we deem them as the bad guys.
Because science means not faith.
Correct. When if we just looked at science a little bit more open, we'd see that science proves our faith more than it does denounce our faith. Mm-hmm. We're just scared to walk down that road because we don't understand it. When we don't understand 100%. Faith, we're allowed to not understand it because there's scriptures that tell us it's okay. You may not know it all. And there's a God that does know it all, and you can take comfort in not knowing it all. So we literally don't even try to know a quarter of what we should.
Yeah.
When science, the whole point of it is to attempt to know it all, knowing that there's a good chance that we won't, but it's in the striving. It's in the process that we discover ourselves, that we discover this globe that we live on, you know, this solar system that we're in, suspended by nothing. You know, it's interesting. So I'm always proud of a believer who dives into science for the simple fact that it takes a lot to overcome those thoughts. And then on top of that, we're going to talk about science of sex. Bruh, every time we talk about sex on this podcast, we get as real as possible because before we did our first one, I was like, we're not allowed to use fake words. We're not using words like pee-pee or, you know, whatever. Like, it's not. We're going to straight say exactly what we're meaning because we don't want to perpetuate the idea that sex is bad or that it's scary or that you should be afraid to talk about it openly and say exactly what you think. So in the last podcast that we did with you, I remember you were talking, you know, we answered the question of if we had to wait and have sex again. If we had to wait when we got married again, would we have sex? And we did a podcast on it as well. And when we said it, we all like sat and thought and we were like, I think we would totally have sex before marriage again, because we realize on the other side of marriage, how big of a part it plays when you are married. So what... Is this type of theme that runs through your book, or is there like a specific theme, or do you just kind of bounce around? Chapter one is science, chapter two is heart, chapter three is mind. You know what I'm saying? Or is there like a theme that's running through the whole thing?
Yeah, no, that's such a good question. So it's kind of broken down into three parts. So we have deconstruction, reconstruction, and the practical. And so for me, I think what I realized in my own story is, you know, you just want to know, so can I have the penis in the vagina or not?
Yeah.
What about anal? Is that sex?
Yeah.
Is anal sex sex?
And is it allowed?
In my research, Peggy Orenstein she is like so amazing. She's a New York Times journalist and she has a book called Girls and Sex and Boys and Sex. And it's 15 years of research in these two books. Wow. But she says that it's something like six times the amount of anal sex is six times higher for people who pledge abstinence.
Wow.
I fell into that.
STDs and unwanted or unexpected pregnancies is significantly higher in the culture of abstinence only teaching and specifically in like evangelical circles.
Wow.
And so much of what I'm doing in this book is saying, let's identify. So this is, we're doing a lot of neuroplasticity work here. Let's identify, what do I believe about my body? What do I believe about sex? What do I believe about sexuality? What do I believe about who I am as a woman, who I am as a man? And where did those beliefs come from? What did I learn about all of those things from home? What did I learn from culture? What did I learn from faith circles or religious institutions? Mm-hmm. What did I learn from my friends? And what do I believe right now? Yeah. And then from there, is that working for me? So it's the first part's all about the deconstruction. And I think, you know, deconstruction is such a hot topic word right now. Mm-hmm. And I think we deconstruct, you know, Richard Rohr talks about, you know, the first you deconstruct so that, I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Rohr talks about how the first half of your life is learning the rules. So then the second half, you can kind of know which ones to break.
Yeah. Mm.
And so the second part is, let's reconstruct. Okay. So this is up until this point, what I believed. Was it rooted in shame, fear, lack, scarcity, victim, external expectations, should? Well, then from what I know about who God is, that's out of alignment.
Mm.
Because I believe the invitation of God is to live a free from fear life, an mm-hmm. abundant life, one mm-hmm. that's rooted in wholeness and hope and possibility. So how can I construct a healthy sexual ethic where I am able to stay connected to my values and who I am mm-hmm. and my relationship with God without the shame?
Yes.
And so then we reconstruct about what do I believe about God? What do I believe about myself? What do I believe about my body? What does the Bible say? Do I care what the Bible says? What does science say? What does my experience say? Because much to the dismay of American church culture, my heart is not deceitful above all things.
Okay.
Actually, my body tells the truth.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
And you know what? If I look back at the trajectory of my life, I realize actually I was spiritually manipulated a lot to be dismissed. My emotion, my body, my intuition, my gut, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to say, was dismissed because I was told my heart was deceitful. But you know what? My heart is actually not deceitful. Mm-hmm. That verse in Jeremiah is actually about motive. Is your motive yeah. pure? Mm-hmm. It's not saying emotions are bad. Like we talked about translation, but it's like, man, actually, so what does my experience say? And if I am made in the image of God and I reflect the divine, then the God image is also in me. And God says that I can hear his voice. So then what's the revelation that I have?
Mm.
And then from there, then let's talk about how I want to show up in my dating relationships. Then let's talk about what I do or do not want to do physically, not out of shame, mm-hmm. but so that I can show up connected to my heart, mm. connected to my body, connected to my values and wholeness, and be able to give informed and enthusiastic, shame-free consent in any of my dating and sexual encounters.
Yeah.
So that's better give an applause for that one. Give her one of those.
Yes, yes. I'm with you. That's
that
it.
Was...
Look, this is what I'm thinking. In the same time, like the intent is what I always tell people about, because there's a lot of people that feel like they're doing the right thing. They're doing the right thing for all the wrong reasons. And it's like, I don't know if God is happy with your right actions and yet your heart is completely off. You know, like it's ideology that we've believed before, that we've been sold on, that now we think is theology.
Mm.
And it's one, yeah, like I know I mentioned in another podcast, but I've been reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, and one of the things he brought up, he's like, I was always taught, you know, because his poor dad was a Christian.
Mm.
I was always taught that
you didn't say that the first time. That's good to
yeah,
know.
The love of money is yeah. the root of all evil. And then the rich dad says
a scarcity mindset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The rich dad says it's not the love of money that's the root of all evil, it's the lack of money that's the root of all evil. Mm. And I let that sit with me for a while. I was like, what does he mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like most people that act out in evil is because they have lack.
Mm.
They don't have enough. So they people who were criminals, who were never think about being criminals, let them get hungry. Mm-hmm. Let them not be afford to buy some food. And you'll see how all the pious turn to criminals real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You see your kid not able to eat, or he can't do this, you can't. Real quick, you'll turn to a criminal so that your kid will have food in his belly. So I thought that was such an interesting thing. It's wow. like, it's the intent behind it. Money cannot be evil. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that you
it's
can do with
intent.
It. It's your heart and relationship towards money, just like with sex. We've deemed sex as evil, but it's really your relationship with sex that makes it good or bad, because you're yeah. going to have to deal with this ideology that you've constructed. And if you've allowed yourself to be manipulated and believe what other people have told you should be sex, what it should be to you, how far you should go, how far you shouldn't. If you take on other people's convictions, at some point in marriage, it's the truth teller. So if marriage is your goal, marriage is always a truth teller. It's gonna shine a light on the ideologies that you have and whether or not they make sense in a very practical way. Because life has a way of showing you where you're shallow. Mm. It always Ooh. Will show you where you're shallow in your belief structure, because something will happen to you that will rock that part of your life or that belief, and it's not as strong as what you thought it was. Kind of like what you were saying. Yeah, it was easy for me to be abstinent when I didn't have any options to date, you know, but opportunity brings like the ability to just compromise. And I've always known that because I was like, I thank God for, and I'm not trying to be vain, but I do understand that I look a certain type of way to some people that may.
What are you trying to say?
It may
say it out. Use your words.
Use your
certain
words.
Certain people have said that I am a good looking man, and I've never had a problem getting what I want. Never. It only happened one time and it broke my heart and it ruined me. And I'm glad it happened because I was living in a false universe. But with opportunity comes a lot of responsibility because of the fact that I can go do these things and get who I want. It really tested my character on that. Hey man, like, what are you going to do with this? And I think there's times in my life sexually where I feel like maybe I took advantage of that a little bit. Was never for the ill intent. Like I never liked playing people out. But I think in my intention of exploring sexuality, I think I may have inadvertently not only hurt people, but hurt myself unknowingly, you know?
Yeah.
But it's because I was chasing a culture that I was told, you know, hide your sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, don't.
Well, Rob Bell talks. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're good.
Okay. So Rob Bell talks about in his book, Sex God, there's a part where it talks about angels versus animals and essentially culture kind of says we are the sum of our urges. So in essence, like, we are animals. And then the church says your angels basically asexual. So you have one saying you are the sum of your desires and we just couldn't help ourselves. It was animalistic. Like, I don't know how it just happened. And then the other side of the pendulum is like, shut it down. It's bad. It's evil. And Bell kind of says something like, the problem is we're not angels and we're also not animals. And God created humans distinct in that creation story. And so when we show up in the world and are like, I want what I want when I want it, and I'm entitled to have it however I want it, in essence, I am using a person as an object to get the thing that I want.
Right.
And so when I treat another person as an object of my desire, there's something in that that is dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. And when I dehumanize another human, I also dehumanize myself.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it to show up in sexuality and in my sexual encounters, but also in life as a whole of how can I show up and honor the imago Dei, the Latin word for the God image? How can I honor myself and how can I honor like the humanness of the other person? How can I be in high worth right now? And sometimes that means saying, you know what, I want to hit it and quit it with this person. And maybe if there's mutual consent and enthusiastic consent, that feels like a good option.
Yeah.
But perhaps I say no to that something if that is going to, if I make that person an object in that transaction. And that we can talk even just, that's not even just sex. Like, we do that with, I used to call it with my Christian friends, we called it stay out till you make out. Like, we're so rebellious. We're going to go get wasted and make out with the guy at the bar. And then I was like, man, I'm totally using these guys. So how can I show up with honor? Like, so instead of what should I do or should I not do? I feel like should is so unhelpful because it does not acknowledge what I really want.
Yeah.
And only when I say actually what I really want is to do X right now. I really want to have sex right now. Well, then from there, I can decide from a holistic place. Well, do I want to do that or not? And why? And is that in alignment or out of alignment with who I want to be? And that answer may be yes or no. I mean, I can't answer that.
Even just hearing you say honor, like, I want to show up and honor myself. It's like hearing it could be triggering because it's so Christian-easy to be like, honor your body, girls. Don't show cleavage. Honor your body. Honor yourself. And really, the flip side of that coin is I am honoring myself because I'm proud of the girls and I want to wear this top. That kind of shows a little bit of a cleave right here. So I am honoring who I am and my body, and I feel confident today and I feel sexy today and I feel all the things and I am woman and all these things. Like, that is me showing up and honoring myself. So it's so interesting to hear just even honoring yourself in a different perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a question.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I don't want you to lose your thought.
Oh, well, I was about to open up a can of worms.
Yeah, open them.
I'll remember my question.
Okay, remember your question. So in that, when we talk about honor, is it possible that the most honoring thing I could do to honor my body, honor my sexual desire in a way where I feel connected to myself, my body, God, is self-pleasure?
Bitch, yes.
You know, is it possible that part of me honoring myself is through masturbation? You know, I feel like that's such a, so yeah, I agree. Honor can be such a triggering word, but what does it mean to have a culture of honor? What does it mean to honor my intuition? Whether I'm told by the church, well, masturbation is a sin, or, you know, your heart is deceitful above all things. Actually, I want to honor my body and my experience. My body is telling me this is a no-go. So what if I honor that?
So this may be
masturbation.
Yeah, that's good.
This may be something then you may have already answered one of these questions, but this came up in my head when you were talking. So what are the top three things that you have learned about yourself in your sexual explorations? Not by not doing them, but when you actually went and did it, whether it's the hit it and quit it, whether it's the, you know, whatever, the panty guy, whatever, like what were the top three things that you learned about yourself that you probably wouldn't have learned if you would just been like, yeah, I'm just gonna pretend to be holy.
I mean, I think one of the biggest thing, one of the biggest things that I learned from a specific relationship that I had was, well, first, I went on a date with this guy who ended up being a guy that I dated for quite a while. And on our first date, I went home with him. And I had, you know, I was almost 30. I'd never done anything like that. I thought, oh my gosh, if you go back home with someone, that is a sin. I thought sleepovers, that's a sin. And so I went home with him the first night. We didn't have, there was no penis in the vagina, but it was, you know, everything else.
All the loopholes.
And that was the, all the loopholes. I was like a game of technicalities, mental gymnastics. Like, I wasn't technically naked because my underwear, this is a true story. I wouldn't let my underwear go off of my ankle. So I was like, I'm not naked. And I would like go home at like 5 a.m., get a taxi cab back to Brooklyn. I'd be like, I didn't stay the night.
Right.
It's 5 a.m.
Technicalities.
And so, technicality. And so I think what I learned in that relationship was, first of all, I felt like the physical was really intimate. And it was awesome. I mean, being skin to skin with someone, it's amazing. It's why they have skin time with babies, you know, like like skin on skin, the oxytocin is released and there's something beautiful and intimate. But I think the most intimate moments that I experienced was the moment after we were physical was, oh, wow. It almost felt like the physical created space and held space for this emotional connection. And I remember one of them, it felt holy and sacred. We're laying in bed and, you know, we didn't have sex, but we were naked and everything else. And the sacredness and beauty of being so close to someone, like shirts off, pants off, and you're just chatting, that felt really beautiful. And I think I always thought I would feel really guilty for that. And I didn't. So I kind of learned more. I think that was really kind of what triggered. I'm playing this role game, but I wonder if there's this holistic vision to approach intimacy with. So maybe it's not about Y equals MX plus B, but maybe intimacy is more robust than like, well, did he touch my butt?
Yeah.
Or did I touch his dick?
Yeah.
Or not? But like, more opening my eyes to a more expansive version of what intimacy is.
Wow.
And then I think number two, what I learned is that sexuality is way more than sex. So I think if sexuality were a book, physical intimacy would be one chapter.
Right.
And I read this book by Deborah Hirsch called Redeeming Sex. And she says our sexuality is the human desire that all humans have to connect outside of ourselves with lowercase o other. And our spirituality is the human desire to connect outside of ourselves with capital O other. And so kind of realizing, man, like sexuality is actually way more expansive than like one physical act.
Wow.
You know? And so I think especially in religious culture, we get so fixated on whether or not we're having sex. And then I think we put so much pressure on sex and relationship and for one person to meet all of our needs, when what if sexuality, like we're in our sexuality right now because we're collaborating with each other, creating something new.
Mm-hmm.
That's what sex does.
Mm-hmm.
Sex makes babies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in collaboration with you two and we're creating something new. So we are bringing our sexuality out right now.
Yeah.
To make something new.
So I was,
two is that sexuality is bigger. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, I did a women's course where we talked about creativity being like at the core of sexuality and, just even practices like pleasure practice and things like that. And in everything that is created came from like sexuality basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just such a bigger thought to think about than exactly what you said. Sex means penis, vagina. That's sexuality.
Right.
And then I wanted to ask you, you said like if this sexuality was a book, chapter one would be like, you know, physical intimacy, whatever. What would be some of the other chapters of that book just to give like a visual of like all-encompassing sexuality?
Yeah. Oh, I think that's so good. So I think one of those chapters would be sensuality.
Mm.
And I think I used to think sensuality was, you know, candles dripping and satin nightgowns. Okay, that can be that. But sensuality is the practice of being present and the practice of being present to your senses.
Mm-hmm.
So babies are actually some of the most sensual beings because you see a kid that found her big toe and she's like, she doesn't know anything else that's going around. She's like, my big toe.
She's
tripping over there. What is happening? But I think the practice of being present is so, we don't know how to be present. And even if we're talking about sexual encounters, the number one libido killer is responsibility.
Mm.
So it's why it's like, oh, I can't get in the mood. Did I need to send that email? The dishes aren't done. You know, there's all those jokes about, oh, you know, if you want to have sex, clean the house. But there's actually something neurological there is when you feel like you have to do something, when there's responsibility there, it kills the libido neurologically. Mm-hmm. And so how can I practice being present? If you want to have a positive sexual encounter, it's all about being able to have the discipline really to be in the moment. So then how can I take that principle and be present in my life?
Mm.
So put my fucking phone down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on your podcast.
Yeah.
No, you can say whatever you want.
Okay. Take my headphones out. Stop the Instagram scroll. Make eye contact with people. I think I did this emotional intelligence training years ago and we had to do 10-minute uninterrupted eye contact with multiple people.
Yes.
And it was the most, you're crying.
Yes.
You're like, this is awkward, but I'm like, this is the freaking most holiest thing I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
You see the humanity of people. So looking someone in the eye is practicing the art of presence.
Yeah. We did that in our retreat.
Yeah. We did a marriage retreat.
30 guys in a room just staring at it. Two by two, staring at each other and not breaking gaze and we were supposed to hold space for whatever pain was in each other's heart. And I have never heard so many people cry. And I started crying just because I was looking at my guy and he's mouthing to me, why'd you leave me? Why'd you leave me? And I'm just like, oh my God, he's talking to his dad. And I just started bawling, you know, but I was fully there. I was, my senses, my hearing, what I was seeing, what I was, everything, experiencing, it was very,
and
very sensual.
Let me tell you something about that too, getting caught up in like church culture, holy culture, and all of that kind of stuff. So then we did the exercise with the men and the women in the room. And you're partnered like in a big circle and then an inner circle, right? The women are in the inner circle maybe, and we keep switching places. And so we're with different partners, different ladies.
Different wives, different, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm with somebody else's husband now. And we have to do the eye contact thing. How much shame I had to work through making eye contact with someone else's husband. Just eye contact was like, this feels bad. I should not be making eye contact for this long because I'm connecting right now with someone else's husband. This does not feel bad, but it's like a human connection. And then next thing you know, tear from my eye, tear from his eye, like whatever. It's just that humanity. It's humanity. It's not even at that point about like right and wrong. And this is sexual, like I'm trying to like cheat or something. This is my human soul connecting with this other human soul on a level that is beyond words because none of us are talking. It's just our eyes are looking at each other going, I see you, I see you, I feel you, I feel you. And it's
just because we were taught like, right, when you're praying at the altar, what's the number one rule? Guys play with guys, girls play with girls, and you pray with girls, you know, make sure that you never cross paths, because if you do, something unholy could happen. You know, we talk about it all the time on our podcast, that's something that it's really hard to break form from. Like it's embedded in us.
Yeah. And I think that what is such a good point about what you just shared is the church loves to play the blame game of how hypersexualized culture is. But the church has hypersexualized everything about the human experience, especially for women. Mm-hmm. So, man, you're saying that guys and girls can't be friends because at the core of every single interaction is sex. Mm-hmm. So we can't even interact because at some point it's going to lead to the bedroom. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that Jesus had provocative friendships with single and married women. And Jesus chose to reveal himself after he came back from the dead. What's that called? The resurrection?
Yeah, yeah.
And who did he reveal himself first to? A single woman in a garden where lovers rendezvous.
Ooh.
How scandalous is that?
By themselves.
Like, yeah.
Hello.
There was no accountability there.
Who knows what happened there? So I think we hypersexualize everything. And I know this is going on another tangent, but I'm like, church, just freaking own it. Mm-hmm. Like, you have all this blame for how sexual the culture is, but what a shame if the only way that men and women can connect is through sex.
Right.
What a freaking shame if I can't connect with 50% of the world's population.
Mm.
Because we can't help ourselves. To me, that's not really a God theology. It's a theology of saying we just can't help ourselves. Kind of like what Bell says about we're animals. I'm like, but we're not animals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So why we got to sexualize everything?
That kind of reminds me a little bit of the stance that former Vice President Mike Pence took, where he would not take like private meetings with women. And it was like, such a double standard. Like, he would with men, but not with women, because he was like honoring like his Christianity or what's it called when you're like
above like, reproach or something.
Yeah. Like, he was like honoring that, but it's so like false humility, like false, like you don't have to do that. Like,
it depends on where he was coming from, because some people do it because, you know, if you're doing it in a pious sense for show, then sure. But if you know your demons, then it is honoring and it's very noble. You just can't come out and say, hey, last time I was
sexualized
alone,
women, I so really I would not.
I want to smash, even though I'm the vice president. So if he knows his own demons, and if he knows if I'm alone with somebody, I'm going to try to be cute. I'm going to try to whatever.
Sure, I guess so.
Then I commend him for doing that.
I have
that.
A little bit of pushback.
Let's hear it. Push it back, because I don't have anything to say.
Because here's what happens in that is, first of all, do we have such a low view of men that we think men just can't help themselves? Do we have such a low view of the male species that we can say, oh man, you know what? We have to keep women out of the room, women out of decision-making rooms. And who suffers from that? The women do. Mm-hmm. Who prospers from that? The men do. I mean, I know Billy Graham did that, and you know, he was looked at as such honor. And one of my friends, Ashley Abercrombie, she's like, that's so messed up, because who got to prosper in that? Other men, and primarily white men at that. women were kept out of the decision-making rooms because the assumption is that boys will be boys, which is just a little bit better than saying she asked for it. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I feel like it's more on the guy. So yeah, if you're like, man, I do want to honor my wife and I'm having sexual attraction to this person, then let's keep the door open. Like, I see that. But even in my own career outside of the church, I feel like my femininity has felt like a liability a lot.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I'm like, I'm just trying to network. I'm not trying to be a homewrecker. And all these guys are referring other photography jobs to each other because they're hanging out.
Right.
But I join the conversation and it's like, my wife this, my wife that. And I'm like, listen, no, I'm not interested in you. I'm just trying to network like the rest of them because I'm trying to build a freaking business here.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do think, if you're like, man, I really struggle with, I'm attracted to this person. Yeah, let's honor that. And I would just really want to challenge, like, why does it have to be that way? Like, is it possible that you actually could have an honoring conversation with a woman and keep your dick in check?
So why you're saying why do you have to give in to your lesser side of yourself? Like, is there a way to not just admit that that's the weaker side of you and then not work it out? It's like the dudes are like, man, I don't like wearing shorts. I don't, you know, because you'd be skipping leg day. But you still skip leg day. Even after you see the weakness, you don't work on it. The only way to work on it is to expose it and to get into the gym. So I do agree. Like, I remember when we were traveling in group one, I remember Pablo said, hey, man, I know, you have a thing with girls and they have a thing with you. So if they come visit you in a hotel, leave the door open. I was like, great idea, bro. So anytime a girl would come visit me, this was at some point at the beginning, I didn't really have a lot of girls come visit me in hotel rooms. But when they did, after he told me that, I had to leave the door open.
Yeah.
So that everything was whatever. And I was like, man, just leaving the door open really does just kill all of the nasty vibes.
Yeah.
Because you're leading with, I ain't trying to get what you think I may try to get if this door is closed, you know?
Yeah.
The door is open, so, well, I'm already starting it off right.
I mean, I hear that, and I think perhaps this is where, like, nuance enters the room, because I don't know how you feel, Angela, but I think especially with...
Hello, my name's
all
Nuance.
The Me Too.
Like, hello? Hello? Hello.
Hang on.
I'm coming in.
But especially with the Me Too movement, I as well feel like maybe I don't feel comfortable being in a room alone with you because are you going to abuse your power with me? And then I'm put in a situation that I don't want to be in. And so I'm not taking back what I just said, but I understand, like, wanting to have the door open or something like that. I think I question when women just aren't given access to being in a room because I'm a female and my body is so temptuous to you that you've made me bad.
Yeah.
Because you can't uphold your sexual integrity. To me, I have a problem with that. And
I used to just call things out, honestly.
The problem extends even into where you were talking about. Like, I'm not taking back what I just said. It's the same thing. If I'm in a room, like, are you going to be integral in this meeting right now?
Mm-hmm.
Talking like Me Too movement. It's the same question. Just men, be integral. Period.
Or just be, look, I used to be really honest. Like, I remember there'd be times where, like, there's certain people that I was, like, super attracted to. And instead of fronting, like, I was honest and I'd be like, when we'd say, let's hang out, and they'd be like, you can come over, you can whatever. You know, there were some times where I'd be like, let's be honest. Like, I think you're fly. And I know this is going to make me sound weak, but I think you're hella fly. And I think that, you know, it's 10 o'clock. And I think if we were alone, there's for sure some things that I'm going to want to do to you. I don't think that I'm, you know, sore on the eye. So I'm assuming you may want to reciprocate some stuff. So let's just be honest with ourselves and be like, man, you know, shit's going to go down if we hook up, like, late at night. So let's just maybe get some ice cream, go to a movie. Like, you know what I'm saying? Let's just be honest with the fact of I'm attracted and I'm going to want to do this. Not because I'm like, I can't handle myself. It's just for whatever reason right now, you are so attractive. And And I am just being 100% honest. And sometimes I got laughs. Sometimes I got people who would be like, but can't you control yourself? I'm like, it's not an issue of controlling myself. It's really not. It's just me setting myself up to win. Because in the moment, most of the times, like, I'm really good at controlling myself. I'm one of those dudes that rarely ever made the first move. More so because I was scared of rejection. So I've never just went up and talked to some girl. Just if I saw a pretty girl, I never in my life. I'm so scared of rejection. I never just went up to somebody and asked for their number. I never did any of that. And that translated even to when I was alone with women. I could never make the first move because I was so afraid of rejection. I was afraid of being looked at as I'm a horny pervert. But one thing I couldn't do was stop the first move. So if the first move happened to me, I'm all in. It's like floodgates. It's like,
oh, go time.
You're good with it? Oh, I'm super good with it. So that's something I knew about myself. So I was like, look, I'm not worried about me doing the first move. But if you get cute and if you do anything towards me, I know for a fact I do not have the willpower to be like, no, I need you to get away from me. You know what I'm saying? So it was just me for more so is just hedging my bets. I think I can set myself up to succeed if I'm just blatantly honest where I'm at. I'm feeling you. Are you feeling me? Yeah, we're feeling each other. We want to do some stuff to each other. Let's just take it to the freaking ice cream shop. Let's just go whatever. Like, let's just identify what we want out of this so that we don't end up, because 9 times out of 10 in that scenario, the guy's going to get the blame for being like, you know, it's an unfair thing. The guy will get the blame for being sexual and being over. Mm-hmm. He should have protected it. He should have whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I think when you share that, what I hear is you giving yourself the permission to acknowledge your desire.
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, I shouldn't want to do this. The most sticky situations that I've gotten into with men is the situations where I'm like, oh, I shouldn't want to do whatever. So I'm just not going to even acknowledge that. So then I put myself in the lion's den and I'm like, oops.
Right. Always.
That happened.
Right.
Always.
Only when I'm able to acknowledge, mm-hmm. hey, you know what? I'm really attracted to that guy that already has a girlfriend. Like,
right.
And that I do want us to flirt. I do want something to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, only when we're able to, like, remove the should or the shame around the desire in itself is not bad. Like, that's not a good or bad thing. It's just the desire is the desire.
Yeah.
And only when we're able to acknowledge the desire are we able to say, okay, so that's the desire. Now what do I want to do? Do I want to do that or not? If I don't want to do that, how can I set myself up for success?
Which is so vital in marriage. Because most people, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, one thing I was going to say is I remember I was always taught, and I don't know if you were taught this, but when it came to accountability, you know, accountability is for men with men, women with women. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There's certain things that you shouldn't tell your significant other because she may not understand because she's not a guy. And I remember thinking about that, and I'm like, wait, but, you know, if this is going to be my wife, if she doesn't know everything about me and something comes out of me, she's going to not only be taken by surprise, but she's going to feel deceived. And it's not even like I was trying to deceive her. It was just I had so much shame around my imperfections that I didn't want her to see me as imperfect. So it was important for me when we were married, I was like, you know what? I need to invite my wife in on everything. The good, the bad, the attractions, the whatever it is that's going through my mind, I need to invite her into it so that she knows that I'm fully exposing myself here. Not because I want to be some asshole who, you know, who's attracted to so-and-so or so-and-so and so-and-so, but because I want to share my humanity with her. You know, hopefully her understanding that, you know, I'm wired as a human. The reason we even believe in this guy, Jesus, is because we're acknowledging that this humanity is not the best if we give in to every desire. But it's even worse if we don't admit those desires, because then you're never going to fully know me. You're never going to fully know what I struggle with, what I deal with. And once you can fully know me, then you can fully love me. And you can know, hey, my husband is not perfect. He has these little shadows and dark corners in his mind and his heart. But man, I love that dude. I love him in his imperfections. I love him because you know what? I acknowledge I have dark corners. I have shadows. And I need somebody to lay this on. I need to tell somebody all my darkness so that we can at least feel like oh, we can come to the light with this. You promised to love me and for better or for worse. And if I uphold these things, then we can literally bring the worst into the light and speak them without shame, holding space for one another. And you'll see how quickly not only trust grows, but love grows, intimacy grows, sensuality, all that stuff grows. That's one of the beautiful things that we found.
Such a good conversation.
Yeah, queen.
I have like a 2.5 minute warning.
Yeah. You're good. No, we.
This has been great. This has been so good.
I'm so grateful that you were able to spend time. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, we both jumped on each other's podcast. So we'll be posting her promos for our episode together. And then you'll know when we're going to post this episode so we can share each other's. And hopefully you guys, the Knights fam, were blessed by Kat and you'll check out all her stuff. Her book is coming out. When's your book coming out again?
April 20.
So this will be
as you should celebrate.
Read my book.
A little reading.
Get a little toasty.
I think this will be out before then. Or I'll make sure that this is out before then.
I cannot wait to read your book. Yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's gonna be.
Thank you.
It's gonna be dope. So definitely check her out, guys. I'll have all our info in the description, and we'll be sharing each other's info. Thank you so much, Kat. We have to do this again.
Thank you so much for having me.
For sure.
I would love it.
And like as we always like to say on this podcast, is we pray you find a seat at the table, but if you don't, you are always welcome at ours. Cheers.
Cheers.
So good.
Thank you, Kat.
Cheers. Boop. I'm in these streets dodging bullets while they writing on my headstone. Better spell my name right, I am not a fake clone. I've been on the run chasing sleep cause my enemies wanna see me weak. 6 feet deep, want the end of me. Oh, look what you made me do. Oh, I got nothing to lose. Oh, look what you made me do. Oh, I got nothing to lose. Try to catch me now. Adrenaline racing through my bloodstream. Always on the edge cause the danger seems to love me. Deadly secrets catching up now. Watch out, I'm gonna take them all down. Oh, look what you made me do. Oh, I got nothing to lose. Oh, look what you made me do. Oh, I got nothing to lose. Try to catch me now. Trying to catch me now.